As we begin tonight, there's one important acknowledgement that we would like to make. This event is made possible by a donation from the Templeton Foundation. Now, this evening, we're offering something new in the Veritas tradition. We're going to have the presentation of dueling points of view. And to set the stage, I hope to make clear what we are discussing and what fascinating and related topics we don't have time for. This is not about the origin of the universe. It's not about its dynamics over time or the age of the earth. Nor will we cover any notion of chemical self-organization. We are not even here to debate common descent. Neither of the distinguished scientists who grace our platform argues with that concept. And I hope you'll keep that in mind when we get to the Q&A session at the end. For this reason, we will not be hearing arguments for and against evolution, however the term may be understood. However, we will be hearing arguments that relate to an issue on which every thoughtful person must reflect at some time. Is there something about nature that seems to point to some external intelligence? For over a century, many have relegated such thoughts to the area of metaphysics, where, by definition, science has nothing to say. This questionable distinction is now fading in the minds of many respected scientists. On a cosmic scale, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence presumes that such intelligence can be verified to satisfactory scientific standards if it resides within our universe. Now, tonight we're going to delve below the concept level to grapple with mechanisms and pathways. We will see biochemistry and even biochemical engineering presented in such a way, we hope, that the non-specialist will be able to follow. Now, this discussion has taken on a new focus since the publication of our first speaker, Dr. Behe's seminal book, Darwin's Black Box. Dr. Cassone is one of many highly qualified critics who remain unpersuaded by Dr. Behe's fundamental challenge. And specifically, Dr. Behe's challenge is that certain biological subsystems are irreducibly complex because they defy explanation by current concepts based on random, step-by-step molecular changes. So without further elaboration, let me say a bit about each of our speakers, neither of whom should need much of an introduction. Dr. Cassone brings a distinguished record of both educational attainment and frontier research. But Aggies, we all need to be proud of his extraordinary pioneering research on comparative aspects of biological clock function and evolutionary aspects in the field that led to the Center for Research in Biological Clocks and the first NIH program ever funded in biological clocks. So A&M should be proud to have him here, even if you're not a student of biology. Now, Prof. Behe's significant publications at the frontiers of his field are often overlooked in the shadow of the furor raised by his formulation and presentation of the principle of irreducible complexity, probably because it's done in a manner that's easily grasped by non-professionals and a challenge to professionals to bring down. As we go into our program, please remember that it was his training and fundamental research experience that led him to this principle. Dr. Cassone will speak first.
I am not Dr. Cassone. My name is Mike Behe, and I'm very, very glad to be with you tonight. Thanks very much, Dr. Trotter, for the introduction. Thanks very much to the Veritas Committee for their invitation to speak tonight. And I'd like to express my appreciation to Professor Cassone for his willingness to participate tonight, and I hope it's a very enjoyable evening for everybody. I must say that coming from Pennsylvania, coming down to your campus here, walking around today, I was extremely impressed. Walking around, I felt like, you know, I'd gone into the future. I felt like it was May or June. But anyway, we only have 35 minutes apiece, so we're probably both going to have to talk fast. I know certainly I am. So let me get started right away. The topic tonight is intelligent design necessary to fully explain the molecular structure of life? And Dr. Cassone will give his answer, but I guess you're not surprised to find that my answer is a resounding yes. And let me summarize my argument for you at the beginning, and then we'll go through it step by step. There are five steps to my argument tonight. The first step is that design is not some mystical conclusion. It's not some airy thing. It's what we do every day. And design can be concluded from an examination of the physical structures of a system. The second point is that those physical features of design seem present in aspects of biology. And not only I say so, but everyone says so, even Darwinists. Many Darwinists say so. But nonetheless, a lot of biologists think that there is an alternative explanation for some of those features. But I'm going to argue that there are structural obstacles to Darwinian evolution, which is the alternative most usually proposed for design. And that the grand Darwinian claims rest on undisciplined imagination, not the more minor claims. Darwinian evolution does explain some things, but the grander claims depend on imagination. And the last point is that the bottom line, there is strong evidence for design and little evidence for Darwinism, in my point of view. So the first point, then, is that design is not mystical. It's deduced from the physical structure of a system. I just want to give you one quick example. I don't think this will take long to show. If somebody showed you this picture of mountains and asked you how those mountains first got there, you might say something like, well, plate tectonics, maybe an earthquake, erosion, and so on. And most people would be satisfied with that explanation. But if somebody asked you how that mountain arose, and somebody answered, well, plate tectonics, erosion, earthquake, no. Nobody would accept that as a complete explanation for this mountain. Now, clearly, it might explain some features of the mountain, but for a complete explanation of Mount Rushmore, you have to invoke purposeful, intelligent design, because we see features in this mountain that are not explained by undirected, unintelligent forces. The next point in my talk, I'm having a little trouble here changing, is that everyone agrees similar aspects, similar pointers to design appear in biology. And again, it's not just myself, but for people who are on the other side. For example, having a tough time here. For example, Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, wrote in a book in 1988 that biologists must constantly remind themselves that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. Can you imagine a biologist squeezing his eyes shut and saying, it was not designed, it was not designed, it was not designed? And the reason they do that is because that's what it looks like. It looks like it was designed. Richard Dawkins, who is a professor of biology at Oxford University in England, and perhaps the foremost defender of Darwinian evolution today, wrote on the first page of his classic textbook defending Darwinian evolution, The Blind Watchmaker, that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. He doesn't think they were, but he says they surely looked that way. And he goes on to expound on that. He says, it's not necessary to suppose that the design of a body or organ is the best that an engineer could conceive of, but any engineer can recognize an object that has been designed. even poorly designed, for a purpose. And he can usually work out what that purpose is just by looking at the structure of the object. So Dawkins is saying that you can tell or you can infer design by looking at the structure of an object. Again, he defends Darwinian evolution, but nonetheless, the point is that everybody agrees that aspects of biology certainly do look designed. Now, in the early 1800s, an Anglican clergyman by the name of William Paley first proposed what might be called the modern design argument when he compared biological organisms to mechanical devices like watches. And he pointed to the interactive features, the functioning of the organisms that and machines that both spoke of design. And the resemblance of organisms, the resemblance of life to mechanical devices like watches that Paley talked about, has gotten enormously stronger in the past 50 years. The advance of science has shown that the cell, the fundamental basis of life, is actually run by machines, real machines, machines made of molecules. But again, you don't have to take my word for it. A few years ago, the journal Cell issued a special issue on the topic of macromolecular machines. You see this thing down here is reminiscent of Paley's watch. I think the artist was making the point that like Paley saw machinery in life, so did he. And if you look at the table of contents of the journal, you get there were papers published with titles such as The Cell as a Collection of Protein Machines, Polymerases in the Replisome, Machines Within Machines, Mechanical Devices of the Spliceosome, Motors, Clocks, Springs and Things. Inside, the introductory essay was written by Bruce Alberts, who is president of the National Academy of Sciences and a biochemist. And he wrote there, "We have always underestimated cells. Undoubtedly, we still do, but at least we are no longer as naive as we were when I was a graduate student in the 1960s. The chemistry that makes life possible is much more elaborate and sophisticated than anything we students had ever considered. Indeed, the entire cell can be viewed as a factory that contains an elaborate network of interlocking assembly lines, each of which is composed of a set of large protein machines." And he goes on to say, "Why do we call the large protein assemblies that underlie cell function protein machines? Precisely because, like the machines invented by humans to deal efficiently with the macroscopic world, these protein assemblies contain highly coordinated moving parts." In other words, the use of the term machine is not an analogy. It is meant quite literally, and perhaps an appreciation for how we know machines come about in our everyday world can lead us to an appreciation for how they come about in the cell as well. Well, nonetheless, Bruce Alberts is no friend of intelligent design, nor is Richard Dawkins. They think that there is another explanation, and that is Darwinian evolution. And that leads into my third point, which is that, nonetheless, there are structural obstacles to Darwinian evolution. For example, in The Origin of Species, Charles Darwin wrote that if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down, adding, "But I can find out no such case." In this passage, Darwin was emphasizing that evolution by natural selection was a very gradual, had to occur very gradually. Natural selection had to improve systems in small steps over long periods of time. Darwin knew that if things improved rapidly in large leaps, then it would begin to look suspiciously as if something other than random mutation were involved. It would start to look like direction was involved. Well, okay, let's take Darwin at his word. What sort of a system looks like it couldn't be formed by numerous successive slight modifications? Well, one which is irreducibly complex, or has the property of irreducible complexity. Now, irreducible complexity is a fancy phrase. I made it up to make people think I'm smart. Hasn't worked yet. But nonetheless, it actually stands for a very simple concept. And the concept, I think, is better illustrated than it is verbalized. And so an example of what I mean by irreducible complexity from our everyday world is shown on the next slide. This is a mousetrap. Now, a mousetrap has a number of parts. It's got this big wooden base to which all the other parts are attached. It's got this tightly wound spring with an extended end to press against the platform here and another extended end to press against this other metal part, which is called the hammer, which actually squashes the mouse. And when you push the hammer over, it's got to be stabilized in position until the mouse comes along, and that's the job of something called the holding bar. And the end of the holding bar itself has to be inserted into something called a catch to stabilize it. Now, the mousetrap needs all of these pieces to work. If you're missing the spring or the platform or the holding bar, you do not have a mousetrap that works half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to. You've got a broken mousetrap. It doesn't work at all. So this is what I mean by irreducibly complex. You take away one of the parts, the thing doesn't even work anymore. Now, it turns out things like this are big headaches for Darwinian evolution, because how are you going to make something like this by numerous successive slight modifications? How would you make something like this mousetrap by something like a Darwinian process? You know, what would you start with? You know, would you start with, say, the wooden platform and hope to catch mice inefficiently? Maybe trip them or something like that. And then maybe add another part, maybe this holding bar, and hope that when they trip, they impale themselves on the end of the holding bar. No, it doesn't work like that, because with irreducibly complex systems, the system doesn't work until it's essentially all put together. So explaining something like this by the gradual process that Darwin envisioned is a real tough nut to crack. Well, mousetraps are very interesting, of course. You know, I think about them a lot. But what we're really interested in is, are there any irreducibly complex biological systems, or cellular systems, or biochemical systems? And the answer is yes, there are tons of them. They're everywhere you look in biology. But because of time constraints, I'm just going to focus on one tonight. This is something called the bacterial flagellum, which is quite literally an outboard motor that bacteria use to swim. This is a drawing of the flagellum taken from a biochemistry textbook by Vogt and Vogt that's widely used in the country. Like the mousetrap, it has a number of parts. It's got this part, which acts as the propeller. As the rotor spins around and around, it's a rotary motor. This spins around and around, pushes against the water, and pushes the bacterium forward. The propeller is attached to the drive shaft by something called the hook region, which acts as a universal joint, allowing freedom of rotation here and here. The drive shaft is attached to the motor, which uses a flow of acid from the outside of the cell to the inside to power turning. The whole machine is kept in the plane of the membrane by some proteins which act as stator molecules. The drive shaft has to poke up through the outer membrane, and there are some other proteins which act as bushing material. And although this looks complex, let me tell you, this is just a little cartoon overview of the flagellum. And thorough genetic studies in the past several decades have shown that about 30 to 40 different protein parts are necessary for this to work. And in the absence of most of those, in the absence of, say, the propeller or the hook or the drive shaft or the motor, you don't get a flagellum that spins half as fast as it used to, or a quarter as fast. You either don't get a flagellum that spins at all, or you don't even get one built in the cell, because the cell also has sensitive mechanisms to tell it when it's building something and the building is going wrong, and it will shut down if it senses that it cannot build a functioning flagellum. So much like the mousetrap, this is irreducibly complex. If you take away a number of the different components, then the system doesn't work. And much like the mousetrap, trying to imagine how something like this could be put together by numerous successive slight modifications is very difficult. Now, I've written in my book, Darwin's Black Box, that if you look at things like this, if you look at the flagellum, if you look at the intracellular transport system or a number of other biochemical systems, they look like they were designed. They look like they were designed, purposely designed, by an intelligent agent. And some of my critics have said, and I guess I should pause just a second to tell you that I have some critics, and not only Dr. Cassone. Some of my critics have said, well, this Behe fellow is a known Christian. He has been seen entering and leaving churches. And therefore, this idea of design is a religious idea. It's one inspired by his religious beliefs. It's not part of his scientific work. And that I should get back to work and give up these ideas. Well, I appreciate their concern for my well-being, but I disagree with them. I think the conclusion of design is a completely empirical one, just like this, the concluding design for Mount Rushmore. And I should say that I'm not alone. A man named David DeRozier, on the next slide, who is one of the pioneers in elucidating the structure of the flagellum, wrote in Cell in 1998 that, more so than other motors, the flagellum resembles a machine designed by a human. So he also sees what I see. And again, let me reiterate that we can come to a conclusion of design from observing the physical structure of a system. And here's an example of that. This is a Far Side cartoon. And we've got a troop of jungle explorers here. And the lead explorer has been strung up and skewered. And this fellow turns to this guy and says, "That's why I never walk in front." Words to live by, let me assure you. Now, everybody in this auditorium looks at this cartoon, and you immediately realize this was designed. This was no accident. As a matter of fact, the humor of the cartoon depends on you recognizing the design. But how do you know that? How do you know this was designed? Is it a religious conclusion? Probably not. No, you know this is designed because you see a number of parts interacting with each other with great specificity to do a task that the parts by themselves could not do. You take one away, this is likely to fail. So you see in this something like what I mean by the term irreducible complexity. Now, there's a lot more to say about intelligent design, and much has been said by a man named William Dembski, whose writings I recommend heartily to you. But I want to, before I leave the flagellum, I want to emphasize that what I've talked about so far is only the tip of the problem for Darwinian evolution. There are many more difficulties for understanding how something like this could come about in a gradual fashion. One is, how do you build a structure like this? And let me just tell you without showing you that it's an extremely intricate process putting this thing together. Putting together an outboard motor or a building or something is comparable. You have to take the utmost care. The cell has to take the utmost care. The second thing is, why do these things stick to each other? What are these little tube-like things? Well, this is a little cartoon drawing, and a lot of the complexity of the flagellum is left out just to get across the concept. But nonetheless, these little parts are all made out of protein molecules. And the protein molecules themselves have very convoluted shapes and are indeed very complex, too. The reason that the parts of the machine stick together is because they have complementary surfaces, which are designed to fit to each other. And the chemical groups on the surface, here's a little cartoon of that taken from Vogt and Vogt textbook, are designed to be complementary to each other. For example, this group here matches up with that group there. This one here from this small molecule matches up with that one there. So the point I want to get across is that there's many more problems besides the ones that I spoke about briefly right now. But again, in the interest of time, I'm going to have to continue on. I'm going to skip this slide just so I can stay on schedule. Okay, the fourth part of my claim is that although many scientists think Darwinian evolution can explain these things, the claims, in fact, rest on undisciplined imagination. In my book, Darwin's Black Box, I claimed not only that these things look designed, but also that there were no studies showing how Darwinian processes could produce such things as complex as the flagellum. The general reaction to, let me just, I'm going to zing past a couple again in order to stay with the clock here. The general reaction to my argument has been succinctly summarized in a book by a man named Franklin Harold, who is an emeritus professor of biochemistry at Colorado State University, in a book called The Way of the Cell, which was published by Oxford University Press a few years ago, a very prestigious academic publishing house. And he gave what is the typical reaction to my claims by many professional scientists. He wrote in the book, "We should reject, as a matter of principle, the substitution of intelligent design for the dialogue of chance and necessity." And he cites my book. "But we must concede that there are presently no detailed Darwinian accounts of the evolution of any biochemical system, only a variety of wishful speculations." Well, let's take a second just to notice the two points that Franklin Harold makes here. The first point is that there are no detailed Darwinian accounts for the evolution of biochemical systems, only a variety of wishful speculations, or more commonly known as just-so stories. You know, like the children's stories written by Rudyard Kipling over 100 years ago, you know, how the giraffe got its neck, how the rhinoceros got its horn, how the bacterium got its flagellum. And it's kind of funny in one way, but if you think about it in another way, it's really astonishing that a theory that claims the allegiance of the majority of scientists should be so utterly unfruitful when it comes to explaining the very foundation of life. And it makes you think that perhaps a different explanation might be called for. Now, Franklin Harold's second point is that we should reject as a matter of principle intelligent design. What principle? What principle is that? I mean, you take a look at the bacterial flagellum, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to say that looks designed. But apparently, on some principle, we're not allowed to consider design. Well, it turns out that Franklin Harold, you know, didn't say what the principle was. He just wrote that and then went on to another subject in his book. But nonetheless, I think I know the principle he was referring to, and it's shown on this next slide. And that is that intelligent design seems to point strongly beyond nature. It seems to have extra scientific implications, maybe philosophical and theological implications. And that makes a lot of people nervous. And some people think that it would be better if science stayed away from such theories. Well, again, I understand what these people are thinking, but I disagree with them. I always thought, and I think the public's perception of science is as a no-holds-barred search for the truth. And if a theory has philosophical or theological implications, well, let the philosophers and theologians worry about that. Okay, in the last part of my talk, I'm going to address one particular criticism of intelligent design that I think is particularly telling. And it has to do with the blood clotting cascade. In Darwin's Black Box, I had written that the blood clotting cascade, which, as this slide shows, has a number of protein components, maybe two dozen or so, where one component acts on the next, which acts on the next, and so on. And I said this appeared to be irreducibly complex for reasons I lay out in the book, and therefore required intelligent design. But a man named Russell Doolittle disagreed with me and wrote about that in an essay called A Delicate Balance, which was published in Boston Review, which is put out by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And that's not good for me because Russell Doolittle is an eminent biochemist, a professor of biochemistry at the University of California, San Diego, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, who has studied the blood clotting system for the past 40 years. So he's not the kind of guy you want on the other side. And he said that not only did he think my ideas were wrong, he said there's experimental evidence to show that the blood clotting system is not irreducibly complex. He wrote in his essay, he said, recently the gene for plasminogen, there's an S missing there, it's a typo, was knocked out of mice, and predictably these mice had thrombotic complications because fibrin clots could not be cleared away. Plasminogen is a kind of biochemical scissors that clears away clots once their job is done. Fibrinogen and fibrin are the stuff of the clot material itself. Not long after that, the same workers knocked out the gene for fibrinogen in another line of mice. Again, that's the precursor of the clot material. Again, predictably, these mice were ailing, although in this case, hemorrhage was the problem. And what do you think happened when these two lines of mice were crossed? For all practical purposes, the mice lacking both genes were normal. Contrary to claims about irreducible complexity, the entire ensemble of proteins is not needed. So he's saying that this idea of irreducible complexity is not only misbegotten, but there is experimental evidence showing that it's wrong. So if you knock out, so instead of the blood clotting cascade having to arise by, say, a couple dozen proteins coming together at once, maybe it could arise two at a time or something like that. He doesn't really develop his argument beyond that. But I don't think we really have to spend too much time on this because it turns out that Russell Doolittle is incorrect. He misread the paper that he thought reported these results, and it reports other results. This is the paper that he was referring to. It's called Loss of Fibrinogen Rescues Mice from the Pleiotropic Effects of Plasminogen Deficiency. And Russell Doolittle saw the phrase rescues mice, and he thought that the mice missing both components were normal. Turns out they're not. They're in big trouble. As the authors of the study say in their abstract, mice deficient in plasminogen and fibrinogen are phenotypically indistinguishable from fibrinogen-deficient mice. Now, translated into English, that means that mice missing both components, far from being normal, have all the problems that mice missing only fibrinogen have. In other words, their blood doesn't clot. They hemorrhage. Female mice die during pregnancy. They are not happy campers. They are not promising evolutionary intermediates. Here's a table showing the symptoms of the various mice. Lacking plasminogen, they have this suite of symptoms. Lacking fibrinogen, they have this suite of symptoms. Lacking both, they have been rescued from the symptoms of plasminogen deficiency, but only to suffer the symptoms of fibrinogen deficiency. And the reason for that is easy to explain, but for time purposes, I'm just going to continue on. The same group has gone on to knock out a couple other components of the blood clotting cascade, and in each case, whenever you knock it out, the system fails. The blood clotting cascade is broken, which is exactly what you would expect if it were irreducibly complex, as I had argued. How am I doing for time? I can't see where the time is.
7 minutes.
7 minutes. Okay, terrific. Okay. Wow, I'm talking faster than I expected. I've got 7 minutes to go. All right, I'll slow down. Okay, now. Let's go on to the next slide here. Oops, sorry. So what are we to conclude from Russell Doolittle's mistaken claim? The point is not simply that Russell Doolittle misread a paper. Anybody can misread a paper. Scientists are not known for the elegance of their prose. And when I went back to check out the paper that he cited in his essay, it took me a while to kind of figure out what these guys were up to as well. No, the point, rather, is this. Russell Doolittle is the world's expert on the evolution of the blood clotting cascade. He knows more about it, the structures of the genes, the structures of the proteins, and so on, than anybody else on the face of the earth. And yet, I think you can see from his mistake where he, instead of pointing us to an explanation of where the blood clotting cascade may have developed by Darwinian mechanisms, instead he pointed to a paper about hemorrhaging mice. I think that shows that Russell Doolittle does not know how Darwinian processes could have made the blood clotting cascade. And if Russell Doolittle does not know, nobody knows. Nobody knows at all. The blood clotting cascade is unexplained from a Darwinian point of view. And I think that's a good point to keep in mind, because many people will tell you that science does have an explanation. Darwinian theory does have an explanation for complex biochemical systems. And they'll look you in the eye and they'll assure you that science knows. And let's look at an example of things like that. For example, on the next slide, a man named Michael Ruse up here a few years ago wrote an essay called Answering the Creationists, Where They Go Wrong and What They're Afraid Of, in a magazine called Free Inquiry. Now, Michael Ruse is a very eminent academic. He's a philosopher of science now at Florida State University, and a philosopher of biology who has written maybe a dozen books on Darwin, Darwin's theory, the implications of Darwin's thought, and so on. And in his essay, he had the following to say. He said, for example, Behe is a real scientist, but this case for the impossibility of a small step natural origin of biological complexity has been trampled upon contemptuously by the scientists working in the field. They think his grasp of the pertinent science is weak and his knowledge of the literature curiously, although conveniently, outdated. For example, far from the evolution of blood clotting being a mystery, the past three decades of work by Russell Doolittle and others has thrown significant light on the ways in which clotting came into being. More than this, it can be shown that the clotting mechanism does not have to be a one-step phenomenon with everything already in place and functioning. One step in the cascade involves fibrinogen, required for clotting, and another, plaminogen. Well, that's missing an S there. There's a typo. Plaminogen, required for clearing clots away. And he goes on to quote exactly that quotation from Russell Doolittle that I showed you a couple slides ago. It's missing an S, just like in Russell Doolittle's essay. He copied Russell Doolittle's argument. Now, here's an academic who is getting into the middle of a dispute between two scientists and does not feel the need to even look up the paper over which it is being disputed. He does not even think it's necessary to know the names of the proteins involved. Some people are so confident that the standard answer of Darwinian evolution is correct that they don't feel that they have to inquire further. I think I'll actually... how much time now do I... 2 minutes. Okay. Let me skip ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going backwards. Okay. Let me skip ahead then to say that the bottom line of my argument is that I think there is strong evidence for design and little evidence for Darwinism. The little evidence, I think, I hope I showed you by demonstrating that many scientists agree that Darwinian explanations are not in the literature, and by showing you an example of somebody who thought there was and yet was mistaken in his thought. The strong evidence for design, is what everybody perceives in biology. The structure of the flagellum, the structure of the blood clotting cascade, the structure of many aspects of biology uniformly give people the impression of design. And they do it for a reason, because we have all of these parts ordered to a purpose beyond the parts themselves. And in a nutshell, the argument reduces to this, that if it looks like a duck, and if it walks like a duck, and if it quacks like a duck, then we are justified in concluding, until somebody shows us very strong evidence otherwise, that in fact it's a duck. The strong appearance of design, as well as the difficulties we see for alternative explanations, give us a strong reason to think that actual design is correct for biology. And the duck just represents what is actually has a noble history in philosophy. It is an inductive argument. Whenever we see systems of a certain type and degree of complexity, such as we see in the cell, such as we saw with the jungle trap, we have always found such things in our everyday world to be designed. We know of no other explanation, Darwinian claims notwithstanding, for such systems in the cell, and the design argument says that we are justified in concluding by induction that such systems are designed as well. Now, I addressed a couple of criticisms of my argument tonight, but there have been many other criticisms of the design argument which have appeared since my book was first published, coming up on 9 years ago now. And I have written a couple of responses to critics, a couple of articles in Philosophy of Science journals, a couple of book chapters, but most accessibly, they can be found at this place on the web for those who are very interested in the detailed nitty-gritty of these arguments. These are my responses to critics. If you want to find the critics' essays and arguments themselves, they're easy to find, too. You just go to a search engine, type in my name plus any common swear word, and you'll get loads of hits. So thank you very much for your attention.
Let's see if this works. To quote the speaker, whoop. Aha. So the title of this symposium is quite cumbersome and long, but in fact, I have an alternative title. Maybe not. Unfortunately, I don't have my reading glasses. Okay. And that is, irreducible complexity. Living organisms are redundantly complex with interchangeable molecular parts, which, if designed at all, are designed with a distinct lack of intelligence. Rather, the more parsimonious explanation is that they have evolved by a combination of mutation, selection, genetic drift, and an immense expanse of billions of years of good old-fashioned time. Now, that sounds like a more cumbersome title, but in fact, it exemplifies the way I think about this, is that the complexity that Dr. Behe alludes to is really a simplistic view of biological processes, and that organisms are, in fact, comprised of multiply redundant, complex systems of vast numbers of interchangeable parts that have been borrowed, reconfigured, and reemployed for a multitude of different mechanisms, and that this is the level of complexity that not of an efficient, intelligent designer might make, but rather a muddled, random walk of things that happen to work over eons and eons and eons of time. Now, why would a scientist come up here? Obviously, this is a venue that is not particularly friendly to scientists. But in my mind, there really are only two fundamental questions in all of biological research and education, and that's here. I don't think this thing is working, unfortunately. What is the nature of the biodiversity on this planet, and how did this biodiversity arise? And the second question is, How does the complexity of living organisms arise from their genetic code, and how is that regulated? So the subject of this debate speaks to the very heart of biology, and has so since 1859. And in that year, as we all know, was when Charles Darwin, as Dr. Behe pointed out, reported on years and years of extensive research from his gardens in England and from a year-long or several-year-long trip on the HMS Beagle from 1831 to 1836. And he understood from his observations of fossils, of geological changes, of the vast variety of organisms that he saw, how they were related to one another, and how they were distributed in space, that there was an order to it all, and sought to explain that order. And he did so initially with his book, The Origin of Species. Most people think that Darwin's theory is just one theory, but in fact, many scholars of Darwin says that there are really five distinct theories, and this is my version of the five different theories. The first is the Earth is very old and has geologically changed over time. Darwin borrows this from some of his mentors, Charles Lyell in particular. And we know from fossil evidence and geology that this is true. The Earth is some 4.5 billion years old. Secondly, organisms reproduce a surplus of progeny that carry inherited characteristics from their parents. We all know this. We all know that we inherit things from our parents, and we all know that especially in the animal and plant world, organisms produce far many individuals than can survive. Thirdly, progeny express inherent variability in their inherited characteristics. This also is common knowledge. You look like your brother and you look like your sister, but you're not exactly alike. And the reason you're not exactly alike is you share some genes, but not all of your genes. And here's the real controversial part. This is the part that people don't like. The environment selects for adaptations to the environment and against maladaptive progeny. If you are not adapted appropriately for the environment, you will not reproduce and continue your traits to the next generation. And that through successive minor variations over eons and eons of time, progressive changes in innumerable progeny gradually results in the diversification of many forms of life. So I just have a question. How many in this room think that this theory and its modern derivatives of some 150 years of very intense research on this subject reasonably account for the diversity and complexity of the living world? I'd say about 50%. Well, you share your views in large part with Dr. Behe, because on page 5, as Dr. Trotter pointed out, for the record, I have no reason to doubt that the universe is the billions of years old that the physicists say it is. Further, I find the idea of common descent, that organisms share a common ancestor, fairly convincing and have no particular reason to doubt it. Well, that's pretty much the entire theory. What Dr. Behe does not agree with is the mechanism by which that changes. And crucial to the subject, Dr. Behe indicates that, and correctly so, that Darwin did not know the mechanism of inheritance or the biology at the molecular level, at the cellular or even tissue level. And thus, Darwin treated all biological mechanisms as he called a black box. And his phrase is, we now know that far, far from being formed from a kind of simple uniform protoplasm, as many 19th century scientists believed, every living cell contains many ultra-sophisticated molecular machines. Well, I don't think anybody would disagree with that, although I do think that many 19th century scientists might chafe at the idea that they thought cells were just bags of protoplasm, because that just simply isn't true. But crucial to the argument is Darwin's challenge to the world, and that is, as Dr. Behe also said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. And, as we've heard many times, there are some systems, according to Dr. Behe, that are irreducibly complex. And this is stated in many ways. Some systems are difficult to form by successive modification. Not impossible, but difficult. And that irreducibly complex systems contain several well-matched interacting parts. And I want you to focus on this word parts, because we may disagree what parts are in a little while. Each contributes to the system's basic function. And that removal of any part of the system will result in its loss of function, complete and utter loss of function. Not that it goes a little slow, not that it goes a little fast, loss of function. And thus the system must have been created as a whole unit. His metaphor is now well known to you. It's a mousetrap. It contains five parts. Actually, it contains a lot more parts than that. Because there are staples that attach this thing, and if without the staples, it doesn't work either. But the flat wooden platform, that's really important. The hammer, which does the crushing and the dirty business, that's very important. The spring, which drives the hammer onto the head of the unsuspecting mouse or rat or whatever, that clearly is important. The catch that contains the little piece of cheese or bologna or whatever you put on there, that also attaches to this holding bar to prevent the hammer from slamming onto the unsuspecting mouse, that's critically important. And as Dr. Behe correctly stated, removal of any one of these components renders the mouse trap completely useless. Thus, a mouse trap, as defined here, is irreducibly complex and could not have evolved from intermediary steps. Could not. Absolutely. Because any precursor to an irreducibly complex system that is missing a part is, by definition, non-functional. Well, it turns out that the U.S. Patent Office has some 4,400 patents of mousetraps. It's almost a joke in patent offices of building a better mousetrap. And sure enough, there are predecessors of the mousetrap. For example, the 1870 mousetrap that instead of using a spring, uses a weighted door. Or the 1886 Holland mousetrap that uses the weight of the mouse to trap the mouse. These precede the 1897 Atkinson mousetrap, which is the mousetrap that we think of. But even that was modified and borrowed. Some of the concepts were borrowed from some of these predecessors and continued to evolve, and I use that phrase specifically, into the 1920 mousetrap, which is by James Dowd. And then this mousetrap continued to evolve and continues to evolve today. We have one that plays on the fact that mice like to go down burrows and can't turn around in a burrow in the Pearsall mousetrap. And here the Smith mousetrap of 1980 uses the Pearsall tube along with the spring-loaded trap, along with the weighted door to have an even more complicated mousetrap. So mousetraps evolve. Irreducibly complex mousetraps have evolved and continue to evolve. But mousetraps are not biological organisms. Can we find a biological organism that fulfills this criterion that nullifies the theory of evolution? Well, here's a Venus flytrap, Dionaea muscipula. It's kind of a cool plant. Everybody's seen them. They sell them in grocery stores and, and then they die on your windowsill. The mousetrap, I mean, Venus flytrap, like the mousetrap, has some irreducibly complex components. First of all, you have two lobes. It looks like this picture is a little dark. You have two lobes here. Then you have a hinge here, which is the midrib of this leaf. This is actually a modified leaf. And then you have trip hairs here, which are kind of like the catch of a mousetrap. And you have spikes, which are the hammer of the mousetrap. Now, removal of any one of these parts makes the Venus flytrap completely useless. If you take away one of the lobes, it doesn't catch a fly. Take away the hinge, doesn't catch a fly. Take away the trigger hairs, doesn't catch a fly. Take away the spikes, doesn't catch a fly. But normally, when this, as this cricket might go up, detects a scent in the leaf, will walk on those trigger hairs. The trigger hairs set up a change in the turgor of the cells, and then this changes the formation of the flytrap. The flytrap closes, and these spikes form a cage, and eventually this poor unsuspecting cricket ends up getting its juices squeezed out. This irreducibly complex biological system probably evolved from this plant, or a common ancestor of this plant. This is the round-leafed sundew. It's the Venus flytrap's closest relative. This flytrap has several parts. It has two lobes of its leaf. And when the fly comes that is attracted to the scent, lands on this, the spikes or tentacles, if you will trap this fly. And then, just like the Venus flytrap, the two lobes close over it. Now, in this case, the likely ancestor, and I should say there are six genera of this family of plants, such that we have many intermediates of this plant in between the Venus flytrap and the sundews. This plant achieved this kind of irreducible complexity by losing a part, and one part only, the sticky dew. So a sundew with its sticky dew converts to a flytrap. But really, even this question begs, even this evidence begs the question, how really do complicated mechanisms evolve? And are they really irreducibly complex? First of all, I think we need to disavow ourselves of the notion that these mechanisms contain a single copy of these parts by asking, what exactly are these parts? Any freshman biology student, and some of you are in this audience, knows, or should know, that although cellular activity derives from the activities of proteins or derived from the products of these proteins, that the code of these proteins derives from the sequence of DNA or genes, and that although there are modifications of this sequence in the RNA that's transcribed from the gene and of the protein that is translated from this mRNA, that in fact the sequence of the gene itself is the substance that is inherited by our progeny, and is therefore the variability of that substance is what evolution acts upon in its phenotypic form. Now, it turns out that this kind of area is the area of genetics, and likely was started by a Catholic monk by the name of Gregor Mendel, who was a contemporary of Darwin, although Darwin never really knew about Mendel's work. And Mendel did a lot of work on interbreeding pea plants by crossbreeding with pollen onto the into the flowers and looking at the progeny and carefully identifying different traits. For example, flower color, flower position, seed color, seed shape, pod color, stem length, and many others. And among other things that he showed, he demonstrated that there are dominant and recessive traits that persist in a population, and that these recessive traits carry an inherent variability when plants with purple flowers are bred with white flowers. When we breed these flowers to each other, we get the first generation of all purple flowers. Why? Because the purple gene is dominant over the white gene. But we don't lose the white gene. When we breed these purple flowers together, we always get some white flowers back. That's because there is a recessive trait or recessive gene in the population for white flowers. And many of these other traits have similar diploid activity. In other words, for each of these autosomal genes, we have two copies. And by that nature alone, nothing in a diploid organism is irreducibly complex. Nothing. Humans are just other peas in the pod, if you will. We have dominant and recessive traits as well. For example, freckles is dominant. No freckles is recessive. A widow's peak is dominant. Straight hairline is recessive. Free earlobes are dominant, and attached earlobes are recessive. That means if you have an attached earlobe, you had to have inherited a recessive attached earlobe from your mother and one from your father. Now, this might get you in trouble with family if there's a problem with paternity, but it is exemplary of the concept that we have two copies of active genes that are working always that determine our traits. Just look around you, and you can see the variability induced by this kind of phenomenon. It also encodes diseases. For example, here is the line of a family in New England that carried congenital deafness. And poor Jonathan Lambert was deaf. He carried two recessive genes for deafness. And he was lucky enough to marry old Elizabeth Eddy, who had a hearing, but she also carried a recessive deafness. And as a consequence, some of their children were heterozygous for hearing and were able to hear. But some unfortunate children carried the two recessive disorders and were deaf. So within the population, there are both detrimental and beneficial variabilities in the population carried by that recessive gene, that extra gene that we all carry within us. And we all know this. We all depend upon this. If you did not depend upon this, why would you have, if you were pregnant, prenatal tests for recessive disorders? You know that there is the possibility of a trait gone undetected, and this is why you do it. Now, one of the less talked about examples from Dr. Behe's book of Irreducible Complexity involves human vision. And human vision is really, really complex. It turns out that I know a little something about it. And let's just talk about the retina itself, because to talk about the entire visual system would be even more complicated. Here is a diagram of the eye. Light goes through the cornea, goes through the aqueous humor, goes through the iris, through the lens, through the vitreous humor. And then here's a blow-up of the neural retina. And there's a curious formation of the retina. The retina is built backwards in vertebrates. Light has to go through the optic nerves, through the ganglion cells, through the internuclear layer, through the amacrine and horizontal cells, through the cell bodies of the photoreceptors called the outer nuclear layer, and all the way through the outer segments of the photoreceptors before it hits these discs. And it's on these discs that the known photoreceptors, the rods, here shown rod-like, and the cones, shown here, cone-like. And it is at this level that Dr. Behe says there is irreducible complexity. And it's shown here on the disc of a single rod. Now, normally you have a rhodopsin molecule, and inside the rhodopsin molecule, which is a protein, an opsin molecule, there is a retinaldehyde pigment, which is bent at the 11 position, and so it's called 11-cis retinaldehyde. And there are many other proteins in this configuration. There's transducin, there's a phosphodiesterase, and there's a cyclic GMP-gated sodium channel. Now, I should say that each of these, there are millions and millions of copies of each of these. Now, when a photon, hits this 11-cis retinaldehyde after having traversed this entire pathway through the eye and the retina, it straightens out that 11-cis to all trans, and this changes the conformation of the rhodopsin, which then turns on the transducin. The transducin then turns on the phosphodiesterase. The phosphodiesterase, in turn, then chomps up this molecule called cyclic GMP. And cyclic GMP is converted to GMP. Now, under normal circumstances, the cyclic GMP is sitting on this cyclic GMP sodium channel, which allows sodium to get into the cell. So the cell is constantly being activated because sodium keeps coming into the cell. But when the phosphodiesterase chops it up, it reduces the concentration of the cyclic GMP, and then the sodium channel closes, the photoreceptor turns off, and we have let there be light. Now, Dr. Behe would say, or has said, that this irreducible complex system derives from the fact that if you lose a rhodopsin molecule, there's no transduction of light. If you lose the transducin, you cannot transduce the information to the phosphodiesterase. If you lose the phosphodiesterase, you can't actually get rid of the cyclic GMP. And if you don't have the cyclic GMP gated channel, you can't turn it off. So it is irreducibly complex, isn't it? Therefore, it must be designed. Well, it turns out that's not true. Yes, rhodopsin does detect light, but it only detects light in this area. And this is the visual spectrum of light. We all have seen this in rainbows, ranging from violet with high energy to red at low energy. Rhodopsin molecules only can detect light in this range. But we have evolved many different photopigments that are contained in different kinds of photoreceptor cells that can span the entire range of this type of this light cycle, so that those of us in the animal world that can see color see it because of these different photopigments. And many people have studied many of these. We have violet and blue photopigments for blue opsins. We have blue photopigments for non-human blue opsins. We have our rhodopsins. We have our green cone opsins. And then we have our red cone opsins. Each of these opsins are related to one another. They vary by no more than 10 amino acids among them. They are very closely related. But each of them have different spectra of sensitivity. The reds are sensitive to low wavelength or low energy, and the blues and violets are into high energy. Loss of a rhodopsin molecule still allows the green, the red, the blue photopigments to detect light. Therefore, loss of the rhodopsin is not irreducibly complex. We still have the other photopigments. And we know this because there are people that don't have rhodopsin. These are people that have a problem. It's called retinitis pigmentosa. They can't see during the night, but they can see during the day. it's not completely broken. Another thing that's kind of interesting is, see this over here? This human green is not near the other green opsins. Instead, it's near the red opsin. It turns out that the human green and the human red opsin were late arrivers in the evolution of photopigments, and that just the change of this amino acid converts the red opsin, a slight change in the one amino acid changes the photopigment from a red opsin to a green opsin. Now, it turns out that these are very commonly mutated, and we lose green or red opsins. And one of the most common forms of color blindness is the red-green color blindness. And it is a sex-linked disorder, and it's very common. I bet you there are people out here that have it. How many people are colorblind? See, there are a few. Can you see me? It's not irreducibly complex. You can still see. A part is missing. We see it. I just want to show you this because it is a phenomenal set of data. It isn't so that there aren't very much data out there. It turns out that every one of the molecules associated with visual cascade are duplicated. So, for example, humans have two different transducing genes, here and here. They have three different phosphodiesterases, alpha prime, and beta. We have two different cyclic GMP gated channels. So if you lose one, you still have another one. This duplication of genes that encode theoretically irreducibly complex systems stands on top of the inherent redundancy of a diploid system. Not only do we have two copies on one set of chromosomes, we have another two copies on the other set of chromosomes. I'm looking for my dollar sign out there. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see that. Okay. Did you send it up there? Because I was looking for you. Not only that, you can remove the rhodopsin using transgenic techniques. And that is that if you remove both copies of rhodopsin, it kills the photoreceptor cells of a mouse. And I should say that this is not a complete loss, because there are still cones and there are still retinal ganglion cells that have photopigment in them. These animals can entrain their circadian cycles to a light-dark cycle. Now, McNally and I were able to insert a human rhodopsin gene into this animal, and not only does it restore the component, but also restores vision. So not only is there multiple redundancy in all of the visual cascades, but the parts that form the visual cascade are interchangeable. They are not irreducibly complex. Just 1 minute. Even if this is designed, let us ask this question. Is it necessarily intelligent? What is intelligence? Having indicated, according to the dictionary, it means having or indicating a high or satisfactory degree of intelligence or mental capacity, the ability to learn, the ability to apply knowledge, revealing or reflecting good judgment. So something that is intelligently designed should be recognized as such by good human judgment. I already told you that there's a funny backward spot in the eye. These nerve fibers have to get out of the eye, and they get out of the eye through the optic disc. So necessary of this design, if you will, there is a huge blind spot in our vision. Is this intelligent? There are also other intelligent, not so intelligent designs. The human knee, anybody who's played football knows that's not very good intelligent. Requirement for vitamin C. It turns out we only miss one enzyme to make vitamin C. There are many genetic diseases. So one must ask, who is this intelligent designer? And you must also ask this. Irreducibly complex systems seem irreducible only when you do not know all the details. This goes for mouse traps. This goes for any diploid system. This goes for every example Professor Behe claims is irreducible. They are not irreducible. They're multiply redundant with interchangeable parts. And to top that off, there's no evidence of intelligence. Thank you. You're on, Mike.
Will I have my slides for this? Oh, I guess I won't. That answers my question now. Yes. Oh, wow, magic. That's great. Yes. I thank Professor Cassone very much. He raised a number of interesting points. A lot of these are very difficult questions, and so it behooves us to give close attention to a number of. Oh, okay. Oh. I was stepping on his computer here. It behooves us to give very close attention to this. Let me ask here if I have my slides. Not yet. Well, let me just start by addressing his last point. One of his last points was that he sees bad design in the eye. And let me just say that whatever else you think about that argument, consider what type of an argument is. Is it a scientific argument? Did it argue that the eye could be produced by numerous successive slight modifications? I don't think so. I think what it was an aesthetic argument that Professor Cassone, other people have made the same argument. They would not make the eye like that. They don't like it. And if you think the designer is God, then it's a theological argument. God wouldn't have done it like that, and therefore natural selection must have, even though we don't have evidence that it did. But I have read, I'm going to have to zing through here. Can you skip to the end of my, well, to the last slide that I presented, if you can? I would, because it'll take me a while to get through these, and I can't skip from up here. I've read arguments that, in fact, the eye is well-designed, even with the inverted rods and cones, because the structure of the eye as it is, the retina is a very high metabolic tissue, and it needs a very high blood supply. And the orientation of the rods and cones allows a very, very prolific capillary bed. Okay, thank you. Very prolific capillary bed to be, I'm lost here, guys. Okay, never mind. I'll do without slides then. It allows a capillary bed to be inserted right behind the retinal epithelium, close by the highly metabolic rods and cones that need a very high supply of nutrients, a high supply of oxygen. So my point is that oftentimes people who advocate intelligent design are accused of making what's called an argument from ignorance. That is, it's characterized as saying, you guys simply can't see how this evolved, therefore you call it designed. But I would characterize these bad design arguments in the same way. The argument goes, we don't see why that should be the structure that is, therefore it's a bad design. And that's not a very strong argument. Another argument that Professor Cassone made is that there are multiple options. Well, yes, there are. You know, some systems are redundant. Once you have a system in place, once you have the visual cascade in place, Darwinian evolution, I think, is fully capable of duplicating parts and diversifying from a system that's already in place. His example of the red-green opsins, which differs simply by an amino acids, is a case in point. So I agree with him there. But what we're trying to figure out is how the first system got there in the first place. There were not extra parts lying around at that point. The genes that he points to are all thought to have descended from the first gene. Well, how did that first system come about? That's the difficulty. I showed you a slide of a mouse trap. Well, there are rat traps that have two springs to give them extra strength. Spring on the left side and a spring on the right. And you pull it back, you're going to really whack a rat. If you take away one of those springs, it still works. Okay, so in that sense, it's not irreducibly complex, but some systems have redundant parts. If you take away the second spring, it wouldn't work. So in trying to explain the origin of a rat trap, we have all the problems that we have in trying to explain the origin of the mouse trap that I showed in the beginning of my lecture. Let me go to a point of maybe a little bit of philosophy or some such thing. Professor Cassone emphasized that Darwin said, and I quoted Darwin, if it could be demonstrated that evolution could not possibly have produced some system. Emphasis on could not possibly. Well, I think that was a rhetorical trick on Darwin's part. Because in science, one cannot show that something is impossible. Only in mathematics or logic or some such thing are we able to get such a definitive standard of evidence. It's not possible to show that there is no such thing as the abominable snowman. I mean, he might be hanging around the corner somewhere. The true standard, the appropriate standard of evidence is, do we see, looking seriously, how Darwinian evolution could, by numerous successive slight modifications, build complex systems? And if we do not see how that happened, and if we look in the literature and see that nobody else has shown how that might happen, and if we do experiments and do not get very impressive results, then we are justified in thinking that does not look like a very promising route. And that's the standard of evidence that should be applied here. Professor Cassone showed us a number of mouse traps, and they're very interesting. I like mouse traps too, so I appreciated looking at them. But what he did not show is that they could turn from one to another, starting from a non-mouse trap, by numerous successive slight modifications that do not involve intelligent agents. All of the traps that he showed us had intelligent inventors. Since my book... I guess I was not the only one to notice that point then. Since my book came out in 1996, it's sort of been a cottage industry on the internet to try and develop a route by which one can go from some simple starting point up to a mousetrap such as I pictured. And in my estimation, no one has yet been successful, although you'll get differences of opinion. In all of the situations, one sees the person kind of unconsciously using his intelligence to guide the result to an appropriate end. But using your intelligence to guide to a result you want to obtain is exactly the opposite of Darwinian evolution. As a matter of fact, it's called intelligent design. let me see. I'm not good at this extemporaneous stuff. Professor, just one last point. Professor Cassone makes a number of good points, and these are not, you know, straightforward matters, so it's great for all of us to get the chance to think about these. Professor Cassone thinks that redundancy would be a help in Darwinian evolution. And I admit it can do some things, but I'm not nearly as sanguine as he is that it can explain the systems that I showed you tonight. Just to emphasize that, if a number of people have pointed out that the components of the blood clotting cascade are very similar structurally to each other. The structures, the proteins of a number of components are pretty close to each other. Excuse me. The components of each protein have regions that are similar to other proteins, and so on. And so it looks to many Darwinists like these were put together from other components. But let me reemphasize that Russell Doolittle knows all about the structure of the proteins of the blood clotting cascade, knows all about redundancy, knows all about domain swapping and gene duplication and other mechanisms that Darwinists invoke. And yet, again, I think you might agree with me that from his mistaken pointing to that paper, he still doesn't know how that system could have been put together by numerous successive slight modifications. So I submit that if you look at the details, if you don't look at the details, it's easy to let your imagination fill in the gaps. But if you pay close attention to the details, I think that a person who does that will see that the Darwinian evolution of these systems is a lot harder nut to crack than many Darwinists are willing to give it credit. And for myself, I am convinced, of course, that it's so difficult that a different explanation is called for. Thanks very much.
Wasn't sure that we were. I'm trying to get this off. I wasn't sure that we were supposed to talk about whether evolution occurred, and I was trying to focus my attention on whether there's irreducible complexity. And I believe that there is no evidence of irreducible complexity. And I should add that while Dr. Behe indicates that if you look at the details, you can't see it, in fact, the details that I enunciated were at a far higher level than those that he discussed. I should also point out that he is right, that Russell Doolittle did make a mistake. But he was wrong in another sense, in that there are other examples in the blood clotting cascade, and I'm not an immunologist, so I just happen to know this, that whales, and there's probably a whale expert out here, whales do not have Hageman's factor. That's factor 12, the beginning of the process. And yet their blood clots perfectly fine. So, in fact, there is, at least in nature's examples, evidence that there are other ways to skin that cat. I should also say that when one looks at evidence of irreducible complexity, to use Dr. Behe's example, it turns out that he's right. There is 30 to 40 proteins that comprise this. And I should say there are many individuals in this audience who are experts on this particular factor. So if I'm wrong, please interrupt. But here I just quickly looked at, under Medline, a list of null mutations in flagellar proteins that still left an intact motor process. It turns out you can get rid of parts of this motor complex quite easily, and under certain circumstances, the flagellum works perfectly well. So in fact, even in this case, the best case for irreducible complexity, you can remove a spot, a protein, and it still works as a flagellum. But I should also add that there's an entire domain of organisms that have a flagellum the archaebacteria, which are just as numerous as the eubacteria. And these organisms have a flagellum, and they do not have a stator. Instead, they have this mechanism that's derived from the type 4 pilus, and these pilins are related to the flagellins of the eubacteria. And so it's possible not only to experimentally change a flagellum and retain swimming bacteria, but it's also nature's experiments that have flagella that work without the same parts. So the flagellum is not irreducibly complex, even in an organism that's not diploid. Now, I have to say that although I think that there is and should be a separation of religion and of science, and that science cannot deny the existence of a creator or a designer or a God. But you cannot use science to affirm one. And I should also state that a lot of the fervor for intelligent design that's shown in this room, and rightly so, I mean, I'm impressed that you've come to hear this story, derives not from a true interest in intelligent design, but instead derives from a firm belief in a creator. And I should also say that most religious organizations do not reject the concept of evolution. And many scientists have been known to walk into a church and leave. That is not the issue. What is the issue is what is the motivation for wanting intelligent design to supplant science. And I just have to bring this up because the Center for Renewal of Science and Culture, of which Dr. Behe is a fellow, and Dr. Johnson is a program advisor and author of one of the books, has as its governing goals, and this is their website, I encourage you to look at the wedge strategy, to defeat scientific materialism and its destructive moral, cultural, and political legacies, as if scientific materialism has destroyed some feature of our society. And I maintain that it hasn't. If anything, it has supported the political aspects of our society. And secondly, to replace materialistic explanations with the theistic understanding that nature and human beings are created not by a designer, not by an intelligent designer, but right there in front of God and everybody, God. This is a quote. Now, everybody's entitled to their own opinions, but the strategy that is enunciated here is not science as its primary motive. It is politics. And it is religion. And I believe that science should be outside that realm. And that's the reason that I came here tonight. And that's all I have to say.
Now we'd like to turn the program over to you. We have microphones at both sides. We will invite questions to be fired from those microphones in alternating order. While Professor Behe is coming up and taking his place over here, let me just mention that we would like to have feedback from the audience about today's session by having you participate in an online survey. So rather than filling out a lengthy questionnaire now, we're going to pass papers through the audience, and if you put your email address on it, sign up, circulate, we will make sure that you find our website where you can critique what we've done. And I've been told that those sheets should not wander back to the dorm or the apartment
They should be left here with Kathy. Kathy, who are you? If you can't find Kathy, leave it on the seat. Do not take it home. We are obligated to be out of this room by 10 o'clock. We would hope that you can stay and ask questions till you're satisfied, but up to a point. Because time is limited, we would appreciate that you get to the kernel of your question very quickly, even though I realize some questions will require a bit of a preface to make their point. So let me start over on this side.
I have a question for Dr. Behe. Well, number one, I want to ask you, do you think you can kill a mouse by hitting it on the head with a hammer?
I think you can. I think it's been done.
So that would be a mousetrap that works with only one of the five components?
That wouldn't work at all. You need somebody to hit it.
Okay, it only works with two of the five components.
No, there's not an intelligent agent in the mousetrap that I showed.
But it still works. Aside from that, I would like to understand what your definition of what design is. At the beginning of your show, you showed two different pictures. One was of natural mountains, quote-unquote natural mountains, that you said we could all agree didn't come about by design through plate tectonics, blah, blah, blah. And then you showed us Mount Rushmore, and that was obviously by design. And the very premise of design is, I think by saying intelligent design, implies that it's an inorganic structure. If we were looking on another planet for intelligent design and we found a bunch of trees or, say, bacteria with flagella, we wouldn't assume that something lived there that was intelligent. If we found a watch, we would, because it's an inorganic complex structure. How are you defining design in that situation?
I think that's problematic. I think that if you went to the time before Darwin and you saw somebody flew to another planet somehow, and they saw a living organism, they might very well think that it was designed. The only reason that some people these days might hesitate to think that an alien flagellum or an alien organism did not show signs of design is because arguments like Richard Dawkins, say that, well, yes, it does look designed, but we know a reason for thinking it wasn't, and our reason is Darwinian evolution. But then if you go back and you say, well, let's look and see if Darwinian evolution can really explain it, and you have strong doubts that, in fact, it can do what it claims to do, then you're back to looking at something that looks very strongly designed, as everybody, as I said, many people admit, even those who don't like the idea of intelligent design, with no other explanation. And I think people who didn't have that psychological block or that psychological predisposition to, you know, dismiss design, I think they would indeed conclude that an alien living organism just might be designed.
Question from this side.
Yeah, I'd like to thank both of you actually first for coming, because this has been something on my mind and I've really enjoyed tonight. So I just wanted to give you all another round of applause. Thank you. My question is actually for Dr. Casson, and I'm a student of science. I'm a veterinary student, so this is all really cool. But I just kept thinking of all these different animals, like the platypus or what have you. It's got a duck bill, and it's a mammal, but it's poisonous like a lot of snakes. And, you know, it's just got all these borrowed, funky, weird parts, right? And it made me think that, you know, you were talking about borrowed parts, redundant parts, pointing to lack of, I'm sorry, what was the term? Irreducible complexity. And so I guess understand how borrowed parts points to the fact that there wouldn't be a designer that's not irreducibly complex. Because I can take a part off of, say, my roommate's Chevy pickup truck, put it on my Ford, and it still works fine. His truck would still run without it, my truck runs with it. But if there are certain parts that you take away and it doesn't work, then certain things are irreducibly complex. And they couldn't have come about without the advent of all those parts at one time. And I just never, I guess, caught your point as to how they all evolved all at once.
Oh, I never said they were all evolved all at once. I said they were evolved over millions and millions of years of a huge expanse of old-fashioned time.
Well, but let me pose my question, I guess, a little differently.
No, I understand. to get to the platypus. So it turns out the platypus is a hard nut to crack because it has no close relatives among them in the mammalian world. It is a monotreme, which is an egg-laying mammal. Its closest relatives are the echidnas, of which there are several species, but they're not very close. It's on the order of cats versus mice. It's very, very distant. The platypus itself has some interesting borrowed parts, if you'll use that part. So, for example, the platypus has the remarkable capability of detecting organisms underneath the substrate using a sense of electricity. And that's from the pits on its bill. And it moves its bill along like this. And in fact, when a platypus sleeps, it actually moves its bill instead of flutters its eyes because the bill movement is its major sensory organ. Now, those pits are very closely related to other types of electrical sensitive pits in other organisms. They've reemerged in the platypus, but they've been innervated by a different nerve, the trigeminal nerve. And the trigeminal nerve actually is the same nerve that innervates our mouth and our face. And so, in some sense, it's used something that's very old. I mean, reptiles have a trigeminal nerve, and many of the almost all vertebrate clades have the same nerve that innervate the same place and have the same kind of sensory capacities, but just added this other electrical capability. So, in fact, if you look at the details of the physiology of platypus biology, if you will find that there are relatives in the animal world. And so, but we don't have the details. I'm not afraid to tell you, you know what, I really don't know. But that doesn't mean a designer made them. And if it did, you would have to say the designer has a really good sense of humor.
And
question from this side.
This question is for Dr. Behe. Dr. Cassone talked about the problem of individuating parts in these various irreducibly complex systems, and it seemed that I could get it that there were two main arguments he was making. One, that these systems are not irreducibly complex because you can interchange parts, and it seems that that doesn't really speak to your notion of irreducible complexity in the sense of the removal of parts. And then the other thing is, it seemed that he confused a notion of what we might call intra versus inter-system redundancy. I mean, he was looking at distinct systems, you knock out one, and then there's still some other system that is doing the function. But the point of your notion, it seems to me, is that it's the very system itself that fails to have redundancy built in it. So I guess what I'm wondering is, can you speak to these concerns and point to some system which Dr. Cassone would have to accept as truly irreducibly complex? Because he was saying that they're really, irreducible complexity is not even something that exists in the biological world, whereas it seems to me that you defined something that was well-defined and does, in fact, apply to biology. So I'm wondering if you guys could come to some agreement whether irreducible complexity exists at all.
Good point. let me see if I can address that question. Yes, you have to be careful when you talk about these things. If you've got a mouse trap over here and another different sort of thing, maybe a glue trap over there, and somebody says, heck, I can knock out this mouse trap and the glue trap still works, well, sure, it does. But now you've got two systems, you know. And that still doesn't explain how the first system, the mechanical mousetrap, might have come about by numerous successive slight modifications. So you do have to take some care, which I try to do in my book, Darwin's Black Box. A second point is that, let's see, is there a system that we can decide is irreducibly complex? Dr. Cassone and I may not be able to reach an agreement, but let me propose one. The flagellum, if you knock out the correct parts, although there are some parts that are dispensable, there are others which are not. That's another thing you have to worry about when you're trying to consider irreducible complexity. A car, for example, might do without its radio. It might even do without one or two spark plugs. It can't do without all spark plugs. It can't do without a couple axles and so on. So, again, you have to be careful. Since I spoke about it tonight, why don't we talk about the blood clotting cascade? Because I said if you remove parts from that, it doesn't work. And the work has been done. It's been work done by Bouget et al. And it was pointed to by Russell Doolittle incorrectly. But here are some guys who knocked out things at the beginning of the clotting cascade, not at the end where Dr. Cassone was talking about factor 12 and where things are still rather fuzzy. But at the beginning where the biochemistry is well known, you knock out fibrinogen, you knock out prothrombin, you knock out a number of other proteins, and it simply doesn't work. And that's not just my assertion. There's results in the literature that show that.
The specific answer is I suspect there is no place that we can agree. I would say that I did mention that this blood clotting in whales, at least, doesn't have one of those parts. But I also would suggest to you that the clotting mechanism, even if it were irreducibly complex, which I suspect it's not, evolved from other clotting systems. We all know that flies and horseshoe crabs and many different types of vertebrates besides humans have clotting systems that have some of the factors but not all of the factors of the human clotting cascade. And so I think the most parsimonious view is that this complex system came from perhaps less complex systems in other organisms.
Well, let me just point out briefly that you know, that's begging the question to say that we've got this and it must have evolved because there were other similar parts. But one more time, Russell Doolittle knows all about other parts and other systems, and he's thought about it long and hard. And even knowing all that has been unable to come up with an explanation.
I'm sure we're not surprised that our speakers didn't agree. Next question.
First of all, I'd like to point out that before Mendel, people knew all about inheritance, but they thought he was crazy too, and they didn't explain it. But I have my first question is, can I ask two questions?
One.
I have one for each.
That's three questions.
All right. Well, I guess I'll ask a question to Dr. Cassone. Say we're somewhere in the early 1800s, and we don't really know that much about making skyscrapers. So we decide to just use concrete columns, and we make an interior kind of internal skeleton for our buildings, so they'll be strong enough, and we'll trust them, and you know, make a 30-story building out of them. Well, then some smart guy comes along and says, "Well, why don't we stick steel inside of this concrete?" And so now we can make a stronger building. So now we go along, we make the stronger building with the steel inside it. So now this is not an irreducibly complex system because you could take away the steel and it would still work. But if you saw that the steel made the building stronger and you can now make a 60-story building, well, then you could say, well, now this building is irreducibly complex because it is 60 stories tall, and if I took the steel away, it would collapse. So what I'm trying to say is you could have an irreducibly complex system that in the past wasn't irreducibly complex, but it's been modified to become irreducibly complex for efficiency. Do you know any examples of this in the biological world, such as like when organisms billions of years ago switched from an anaerobic to an aerobic respiratory system?
Do you want a month? I believe aerobes originally came about. I think 4.2 million years ago. If that's the question. Is that correct, this microbiology stuff?
Could you have a currently irreducibly complex system that in the past wasn't irreducibly complex, but through some sort of pruning and efficiency process has been made irreducibly complex?
I can't think of a single one right now. But, I mean, I don't quite understand your question.
Well, let's move on to the next question over on this
side. We had another question.
One good customer.
Okay.
Okay. I've been looking forward to this for like a week and a half, so I'm just chomping at the bit to go. I think it's amazingly fantastic that there's as many people here, because these are truly, truly important questions, right? I know that I've dedicated my life to them, and I know that you guys have too. So, I mean, hello.
What is your truly important question?
That's the point. That's what I'm coming to. All right. I want to actually make a comment, and then I ask for feedback, because I have a hard time accepting intelligent design for a number of reasons. But what I'd like to talk about, rather than the biological debate about irreducible complexity and that, you said something tonight that actually pricked my ears up, where you talked about science, the goal of science is widely understood and disseminated through society as producing truth. And of course, truth, we want to know how these biological systems start, for goodness sakes. And it reminded me of what I do every other week and in every class I teach. I'm a social scientist, right?
Well, is that
science doesn't produce truth, all right? It doesn't seem to do that. And my question to you is, do you believe that science, the knowledge it produces, maps in some way onto an independent, speaking ontologically, an independent reality? Is there a one-to-one map between science? Do you see that it has to be that way for science to work? That's my question. Thank you.
Let me say that that's a much broader question than the detailed mechanism we've been dealing with.
Okay, I'd be happy to answer it. That's an excellent question, and it's one I'm interested in as well. And the answer is that while science certainly believes, oftentimes has believed things that have later turned out not to be true, as a little bit of history of science shows, it has always been the goal of science to discover the truth about the natural world. And while I think it's a good thing to admit that science has taken a number of wrong turns, even when it thought it had the truth about the world, even when people thought Newton's theory was the last word about physics, even, you know, when phlogiston was, you know, in its heyday and so on. Even though science does take wrong turns, you can admit that. But if you say to yourself, it is not the goal of science to discover the truth about the real world, about the physical world, then I myself think you're really destroying science. You're turning into game. You're taking away its prime motivation. I'm sorry? I think as a practical matter, you'd lose most scientists doing that. Okay. Well, we can disagree then.
Next question.
Okay. A comment. It seems to me that the pursuit of every scientist should be to understand all of the natural world. And if a scientist cannot say that there's nothing outside the natural, or that thing that's outside the natural could not have possibly touched the natural, then a scientist would have to be able to look at those things within the natural world that might have been touched by the outside natural, by the extra natural, and have something to say about that, because it's part of the natural world. But my question is, in the last few decades, is for Dr. Cassoni, in the last few decades, industrial engineering has made a lot of progress and a lot of has come to understand a lot about what constitutes good design. And I'm no industrial engineer, but I have studied some of those things in order to apply them to my field of computer software. And one of a few of the things that I have learned is that redundancy and interchangeability of parts is not the proof of the absence of design, but in fact it's proof of good design. And it's only in the last few decades that we've discovered that these are good things to have in design. That a thing that is well designed has redundancy in it and has interchangeability of parts as a general rule. So I am not understanding how you can look at those two things. And it seems like that was the center of your talk, redundancy and interchangeability of parts, and point to them as a proof of absence of design.
Let me just comment on your first comment, which is that I didn't say that you can't invoke extra or supernatural events in your life. I never said that. I did, however, say that. I didn't say it either, but I will say that that science is not a compendium of facts, but it is something that scientists do, and they do them by looking at physical evidence. And if you're not looking at physical evidence, you're not doing science. So, yes, it's true that we did not know about oxygen in the early 17th century or a variety of different phenomena, and those were placed in supernatural or extranatural perspectives. But since then, physical evidence came to play that's indicated that these were natural events. The invocation of a designer is by definition an extranatural or supernatural event, and therefore is outside the purview of science, in my view. Okay. Secondly, I was not speaking to design when I brought interchangeability and redundancy. I was speaking to irreducible complexity. In other words, irreducible complexity is the prime evidence for design in Dr. Behe's book. And if there is a large amount of redundancy and interchangeability, admittedly, good design perhaps, or alternatively, multiple genes and traits that interplay in a vast array of genomes over eons of time. That's a different question. You would agree that something that is redundant and interchangeable is not irreducible.
No, in fact, in the production of software, which is what I do, redundancy and interchangeable parts is a part of irreducible complexity. You have a complex system that you cannot take its parts out, and in order you cannot allow any one part to fail. So in order to have a well-designed system, you have to make those parts interchangeable and redundant in order so that if there's a problem with one, your whole system does not fail.
I think we're using a different definition of the word redundant.
I think you had the answer to your question. Let's move over to this side.
Hi, my question's for Dr. Behe. You said at one point that evolutionary theorists have not shown how various things evolved. And I'm wondering to what extent intelligent design theory has shown how things came about. If to just say it must have been done intelligently, is that sufficient, or is that similar to what you see as evolutionist hand-waving when you say it was happened by a random mutation, if you haven't shown who designed it, how, and when?
Okay, that's a great question. I argue that you don't have to show who designed it, when it was designed, how it was designed, and so on, in order to know that something was designed. And let me explain that. For example, I showed the image of Mount Rushmore on one slide. Now, if you brought somebody here from another country who'd never heard of Mount Rushmore, you drove by Mount Rushmore, the guy looks up and looks at it. He doesn't know when that was designed. He doesn't know who did it. He doesn't know how it was done. But he sure as shooting knows that it was designed. That's one of the nice things about design is that you can reach the conclusion that something was designed without having to know its history, just by looking at the system itself. The mousetrap I showed up there might have been, made yesterday. It might have been made a zillion years ago. It might have been made by, whatever. But you can tell just by looking at the mousetrap that it required design because of the way the parts interact. And again, not just I think that, but other people think that about biological systems too. Let me give you an analogy which I've been looking to fit in here somewhere. Consider the Big Bang Theory. How did the Big Bang happen? Nobody knows. And certainly when it was first proposed, the theory was first proposed in the 1920s and the 1930s, nobody had a clue how a universe might pop into existence. But nonetheless, the motion of the galaxies away from each other was very strongly reminiscent of the aftermath of a giant explosion. Many scientists also thought that the Big Bang Theory strongly suggested something beyond nature, something extranatural, maybe even supernatural. You can read some of the literature of the times. You can even read relatively recent literature from scientists saying, I hate the Big Bang Theory because it looks like a creation. It looks like some supernatural event. Nonetheless, physicists of the time felt justified in investigating the Big Bang Theory simply because of the pattern was so strongly reminiscent of an explosion, even though they didn't know a mechanism for how such a thing could happen. Even if it did point beyond nature, heck, look at the data. That's what it looks like. And I make the argument that intelligent design, to me, is in the same boat. What we see in biology strongly looks like things that we know are designed. It has the kind of complexity, the degree of complexity that we know are found in design systems. We don't know how it was designed. We don't know who designed it. We don't know where and all those other things that we would like to know. But nonetheless, the strong pattern of design, just like the strong pattern for the Big Bang, I think justifies our conclusion that in fact, real design is occurring.
Next question.
Dr. Cassone, you talked about Gregor Mendel. He published his findings at a well-attended meeting about the same time Origin of the Species came out. Yet his findings were overlooked. The first American scientist, William Castle, from Harvard University to publish on Mendel, wrote in the Journal of Science in 1903, and I quote, "The Darwinian theory then occupied the center of the scientific stage, and Mendel's brilliant discovery was all but unnoticed for a third of a century. Then Darwinists in the 20th century felt like sequences of DNA that did not code for protein were evolutionary junk and named them junk DNA. We're now finding
the question?
Yes. And I think this will come to be a classic story of orthodoxy derailing objective analysis of the facts in the case for a quarter of a century. That's John Maddock, director of an Institute of Molecular Biology. My question for Dr. Behe is this. Darwinists have cost the field of genetics over 50 years of research when we could have been looking into what the function of so-called junk DNA was and when we could have been investigating Mendelian genetics in the 19th century. Since they've cost us 50 years, is it fair to ban Darwinists from the field of genetics for 50 years?
There's a man with a point of view. Well, I don't think so. To tell you the truth, I disagree with Darwinian evolution. I mean, with its grander claims. I certainly do think that it explains some things very well. Strongly argue that other things besides Darwinism are necessary to explain life, like intelligent design. But I think Darwinian evolution has been a very good paradigm. We've made some progress with it. I think the progress of science itself, most especially our much greater sophistication, much greater knowledge about the structure of, well, about the cell and what makes the cell run, makes Darwinian theory look limited at this point. But I think Darwinists have done a good job, and certainly many of them sincerely, mostly all of them, I'm sure, sincerely believe that they were going down the right path. I disagree with them, but I appreciate their efforts.
The clock tells us that we're about at the time, and we thought we might adjourn to another room, but there's such a large group here, we will not do that, and we will continue while patience endures, but we do have to be out by 10 o'clock.
My main rhetorical idea on this entire debate is whether intelligent design is adequate to disprove evolution, but that's not really the issue. I'd really like to think that erosion can kind of be a cause of why that mountain looks like it. My question is it not possible that our knowledge of biochemistry in the natural world is not great enough to explain such an irreducibly complex system?
Sure. Let me just say briefly, and then perhaps Professor Cassone would like to speak for a while. Anything's possible. You know, maybe tomorrow we'll find a different theory to explain all these systems that I talked about tonight. In science, you can never rule out anything in the future. That's just the nature of the game. Maybe 10 years down the line, intelligent design will be shown, even to my satisfaction, to be incorrect. Maybe tomorrow somebody will come up with a theory that overthrows the Big Bang, or other well-accepted, plate tectonics, or other well-accepted theories of science. Again, that's the game of science, and it's been done time and time again in the past. But my argument is, right now, with what we know, the evidence we see, those things look like they were designed. We do not have another good explanation, and so I say that if we're going to call our pursuit here an open pursuit of truth, no holds barred, then we have to entertain the idea of design.
Next question.
I have a question for Dr. Behe regarding the basis of your theories are based on the molecular makeup itself. It's a very complicated structure that has no history that we can look at for creatures in antiquity. I'm coming from the anthropological department where I'm looking at skeletal remains. I'm looking at evidence of change over time. I'm looking at vestigial organs, vestigial limbs in large creatures. How would you explain something like that if you can't look at the Darwinian basis? For example, vestigial hind limbs in dolphins.
Maybe dolphins descended from a creature that had hind limbs.
Well, exactly, is what but I'm saying.
Exactly what
that's
saying.
What I'm saying, is that's from a Darwinian point of view.
No, it isn't. No. Okay, let me stop and reemphasize something that Professor Trotter said at the beginning. The question we're disputing here is simply the mechanism. So I can agree with Professor Cassone that life, you know, arose and developed by descent with modification, but I do not think this was a random process, or at least in many critical respects, it was not. I say that this progression required intelligence. So one can take that position like I do, and I think freely say that, you know, many features of current organisms do suggest common descent, but the critical question is, how did that process happen? What drove it?
Wait a second. So are you maintaining that vestigial organs are designed into the system?
No, I did not say that.
Isn't that what you said? So that vestigial organs that have no function whatsoever, as is the case of the hind limb of the dolphin, or that have minor effect or reduced effect, those are designed.
No, I did not say that at all. So let's take as an example blind cavefish. Okay, there, as many of you know, there are fish that live in caves where there's no sunlight. And their eyes oftentimes are degenerate and they can't see, they're blind. Maybe that happened by Darwinian processes, by mutation and natural selection. Okay, that's all right with me. I never said Darwinian processes can't do anything. But saying how saying how an eye degrades does not at all answer the question of how you make an eye in the first place.
Just a sec.
For example, let's just take a computer. I can let a computer sit around for a long time. It'll rust or do whatever, accumulate dust, and it'll break. Over time, maybe it'll, break and parts will fall off and so on. Seeing that a complex system degrades over time does not, like a computer, does not tell you how a computer can be built. It doesn't say anything about that. So things like that are maybe evidence of Darwinian evolution, but they do not explain the questions that I have raised.
But there are still less complicated optical systems in other organisms that can just detect light and darkness that preclude this highly systematic and highly specialized form of vision that we have. Just because you have a chain that you can view as a complete object and you can't take off the middle part and have it still function doesn't mean the fact that the chain can't have been built.
Well, I explain this, I think, more fully in my book. It's a good point, but even very simple organisms use the cascade that Professor Cassone had up on his slide. I'm not referring to anatomical features like curving of eyes and so on that could, other changes that might add to a basic biochemical visual cascade. I'm not saying that they didn't evolve by Darwinian processes. I'm not saying such improvements did. One has to look at the molecular basis for these changes to have a good handle on whether or not they could happen by gradual evolution.
But in the case of vestigial eyes, so for example, in the mole rat Spalax ehrenbergii, which has a vestigial eye by all intents and purposes, still retains a vestigial eye that has all of the retinal ganglion cells that still project to the hypothalamus that is involved in detecting light dark in that organism. That organism lost its visual system some generations earlier. That still retains its function.
I'm sorry.
It's not an irreducibly complex system.
May we take that as a statement of disagreement? Move on a bit. I would like to thank Professor Behe for trying to bring us back to the question of what are the steps that might have made it possible. And so, if there is anybody in this lineup of questioners that has a question that is related to the step-by-step mechanism, if you would hold up your hand, I will invite you to move to the front of the line. I see one hand over here. Oh, here he is, right here. All right, you're next.
My question is sort of almost indirectly related to that step-by-step, but you have this step-by-step process, but at what point, how does Darwinism, whatever, evolution, explain the start of the process? How do you explain the mousetrap, the first mousetrap being built? How do you explain the first eyeball being formed?
I tried to rule that question out at the beginning. We're going to concede that it was there.
No. I don't think that's a question of the origin of life, which is what
mistake.
You're saying.
Yeah, no, that's a reasonable question. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of organisms that have. I mean, so the rhodopsin visual cascade exists in some form in bacteria. There's a bacterial rhodopsin. There are many organisms that have opsin-based photodetection. That system is retained from prokaryotic organisms all through unicellular microbes to multicellular animals. So if you just stick with the visual cascade, it turns out that opsin molecules don't necessarily have to interact with a transducing phosphodiesterase. There, for example, the insect eye doesn't use that at all. It uses another cascade called the phospholipase C cascade. There are many different ways to skin the rhodopsin cat. And so, there are many examples of simpler photodetectors that are, if you look at the extant species, are increasing in complexity as you look at the complexity of the organism.
Well, what about, say, like the flagellum, where you have all single-celled organisms are basically born with this motorized function of movement? I mean, you can't How do you explain like where this came from? I mean, did they just start out with nothing?
You know, and then... the person who's standing right behind you is one of the world's experts on that question. So I'll let him answer that.
Why don't we bring our expert on? Let him tell us.
I'm not an expert. I'm a biology teacher.
I met the tall fellow in the back.
May I just make a comment before we do that? And that is, I just want to bring us back to a point that a number of reviewers of my book made, and that is, it's easy to come up with just-so stories. You could say, well, there were these things back there, and, you know, it's easy to imagine they got together with these here, and what's the problem? When one is discussing Darwinian evolution, it's to the advantage of the Darwinist to make things seem easy. And so they routinely, certainly not Professor Cosson, but other Darwinists routinely overlook problems. They do not try to look too hard to see what might upset the apple cart. But nature has to get every step right.
Just for the record, I'm not a Darwinist. I'm a libertarian.
All right, a man after my own heart there.
I understand our expert is Professor Matson. Would you care to step up and...
Yeah, well, I have to. I happen to be working on bacterial flagella for the last 30 years and worked with the guy that first described their rotation, and I was the first guy that showed that, in fact, it was, as you termed it, an acid flow across the membrane that threw off their rotation. There's nothing irreducibly complex about a bacterial flagellum. It is made up of components, each of which has, in a very similar form, a very different function in terms of what it does for the cell, although a rather similar function in terms of the mechanism that drives it. For example, the stator component of which you speak is made up of a combination of different domains, one of which is very much like things that bind to the peptidoglycan cell wall, which allows it to serve as a stator. Another part of which is very much like many ion channels, and the flow of protons through that channel element drives a conformational change in that protein, as it does in myriads of other proteins in the membrane that couple the flow of hydrogen ions through them to some kind of work. The structure that you show as the rotor, in fact, resembles very closely devices used for secretion of pathogenic factors, little injection needles that serve in many pathogenic bacteria to insert toxins into eukaryotic cells. Flagella, these structures that come out, do have a function, even without their being able to rotate. They are adherence appendages, much like pili are. And they have an important role in pathogenesis as adherence appendages, independent of their ability to rotate. And this whole device, wonderful device indeed, for exporting proteins out to the center of this complex structure, is seen in various manifestations in all kinds of microbial systems and serves a very nice function of making things on the outside of a cell. So there's nothing about a bacterial flagellum that's mysterious or any of its components that don't find close parallels in other places within a bacterial cell. And new flagella, the guy in the orange shirt ahead of me asked, how are the new bacteria born with it? Well, it turns out that they assemble. They self-assemble. And complicated proteinaceous structures inside of cells do have the property of self-assembly. And if you want to have equivalent interactions of components, of protein components within some complex structure, how are you going to make them? Are you going to make them a square, a triangle? No. You're going to make them a circle. You're going to make them a ring. That is simply the most parsimonious way of putting a whole bunch of proteins together to get them to do something. So in your particular example of a bacterial flagellum, I think you're really shooting blanks when you say there are not individual components of that that have functions on their own.
Professor Matson, if you would return to the microphone, I'd like to ask, in the spirit of what we were trying to do in the first place, because there are these many very similar entities which have comparable functions, could you tell us, from your depth of knowledge, which components of any of those have been taken out and they still did what they were doing?
Well, I think that was the essence of the question of the skyscraper guy. The
skyscraper
guy was asking, if you started off by making buildings with concrete supports that were 30 stories tall, and then realized that you could make 60-story buildings by including steel supports, now, and you took away the steel supports and the building collapsed, did that mean that this was irreducibly complex, and could this not have been something that evolved over time? Now, in that case, you have an intelligent designer. However, one could easily imagine incorporating some structural element, some kind of rigid protonaceous rod into something that needed more structural strength and have a basic precursor structure that didn't need that because it didn't move as robustly or need to be as resistant that would incorporate such a thing.
Perhaps
there are many examples of such things that they could be utilized in a cell.
Perhaps we could move on to that at a later time if we could get together.
Well, maybe I can make a comment here. I think the comment was directed towards me. I appreciate your comments, thank you very much for them. I think you're underselling the structure that you study. Again, you say that they are components that resemble other components in the cell. Well, again, let me just go back to Professor Doolittle's description. The components of the blood clotting cascade resemble components of resemble serine proteases. There's zillions of serine proteases around. But when you sit down and you try to figure out which attached to who, in what order, which evolution would have to do, you can't, evolution, nature, could not just get up and say, well, let's do this, let's pull this. It has to do one step at a time. It becomes amazingly difficult to do. And if I'm not mistaken, and I try to keep up with the literature in this area, nobody has actually done that for the bacterial flagellum, written down a step-by-step rigorous proposal for how such a thing could have come about.
Well, Dr. Doolittle is not here to defend himself, but I am.
Great.
So if we want to carry on this discussion, I am happy to do so.
Let's move to a question of this guy.
My question is, your assertion that an irreducibly complex system is obvious by looking at it requires a certain amount of ability to recognize it. And the same sense in terms of your colleague is saying that there is, like you said, in terms of the principle that we should reject such assertions. Isn't in both of your cases where the people who are your opponents who are saying that you can't go down that path, and even in yourself, exercising some form of subjective judgment and, in fact, form of faith?
Let me see if I understand you correctly. Is it a subjective judgment to say that these things look designed?
I know a lot of artwork that is obviously designed that serves no function, as far as I can tell. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't designed. And in your case, there's no necessarily a scientific evidence that something was in fact designed. You're simply stating that it's obvious. Aristotle stated his first principles.
Well, that's good, that's also good company to be in.
And in the same case, people who say that you can't go down the route, that you must reject your first principles just because of some principle of trying to avoid influence of faith and scientific pursuits, how do you both answer that?
Well, I try to defend myself by saying it's not just myself who sees these things appear to be designed. And as a matter of fact, Richard Dawkins says why they appear designed, because he says they have something on the order of specified complexity. They are complex and they do something. They have a number of components that allow them to perform some specific function. He's usually interested in whole organisms. So he says they have parts that allow them to fly, to reproduce, to eat, to do other such things. And, you know, so it's not just myself. Francis Crick says the same thing. So I feel that I've got some support, at least in making the claim that some things do, in fact, look designed.
But is that any more scientific than the claims that you should reject your assertions because they may be associated with faith? And how can a person scientifically reject your assertions? Because that's a statement of faith, too.
I don't try to. I specifically stated that I don't think science can deny a faith. That, in fact, those two processes are intellectually separable. That science requires physical evidence, whereas faith does not require physical evidence. That's the essence of faith. They're two separate processes.
Question.
Yay. Okay. Dr. Cassone, you mentioned the background of Dr. Behe and that he is a believer in God, and therefore you say that his motivation for design is that belief, although he presented empirical evidence. Do you believe that there is enough empirical evidence to prove macroevolution? I don't believe so. So if you do or if you don't, and if there's not sufficient evidence for macroevolution, what is your motivation in upholding Darwinian evolution in respect to that? And if the evidence is not there, would it change the nature of biology research? And if so, would it be a deleterious effect?
That's a good question. So there's an enormous amount of evidence of macroevolution. The enormity of the evidence of the changes one sees over geological time in terms of the fossil evidence of a variety of different vertebrate, invertebrate, plant groups is tremendous. And that the only counter-argument to the geological record that is shown for organisms, which is much more detailed than is given credit for, is somehow, as I've heard several people state, a deceptive creator who puts these fossils to trick us into thinking there's evolution. I think that's a highly unlikely prospect, but I can't discount it. So there are enormous amounts of molecular evidence in favor of evolution at the macro scale. The relatedness of all of us to our closest relatives, the great apes, and that group to other primates, and that group to other mammals, and that group to other vertebrates, and that group to other animals, and on and on and on, is so enormous and so predictable that one can only come to the conclusion that they derived from a common ancestor over vast amounts of time. Now, if it were proved by some physical evidence, and there are all kinds of novels, Rogers' Version by John Updike is a wonderful one, that purports to find physical evidence for a creator, if that were the case, yes, it would have enormously deleterious effects on science. It would make science irrelevant. So, yes.
So there should be billions of transitional forms in order for macroevolution.
I think you've had your question. Let's move to the question on this side.
Yes, there should be, and there are.
I would like to read. I would like to return to Dr. Behe's rebuttal of Dr. Cassone with respect to complexity and multiple parts in a system, where you said that once you have a system in place, you can imagine how Darwinian evolution can modify that over time and change it. And you seem to be in agreement that Darwinian evolutionary forces can actually work on a simple system that might be irreducibly complex and modify it to greater complexity. So what you're interested in is trying to figure out how the first system, the first irreducibly complex system, got there. And so the examples that you stated of irreducible complexity are all ancient examples, bacterial flagella, the blood clotting system, all of which predate mammalian diversification. And if you're going to search farther back in time to find an even simpler system,
is there anything that you would imagine as irreducibly complex that would separate human beings and chimpanzees or human beings and monkeys or human beings and rats and mice or human beings and lizards, for example? So in other words, what has the designer been doing in the last 250 million years?
Well, that's easy to answer, is that we don't know. We don't have enough knowledge of the differences of what it takes, what it would take to make a primate from a rodent-like ancestor.
Are there biological machines that are seemingly different between these species? All the examples that you want to cite for irreducible complexity of these complex biological machines, of which you assert there are an enormous number,
are
ancient examples. Are there any?
There are. They're the ones we know best. And the question is, even given those machines, what sorts of changes do we need to explain, you know, some change from one sort of animal to another? And the question is, you know, we don't know. What does it take to make a human from a chimpanzee? We don't know. Is that possible to make that change by natural selection? We don't know, because we don't know what it would take. What would it take to make a primate from a rodent-like ancestor? One more time, we don't know. I try to confine my argument to what we know best. I think it's bad policy in general to try to speculate on systems that you don't know. So I always say that things like that may have happened by Darwinian evolution, but they may not have. We simply don't have enough data to say at this point.
Question on this side.
I wanted to comment that the major issue to me is whether things are designed or not. So coming to Veritas tonight has thinking about all these things and has proved to me that there is a designer, that this building did not land here. It
Do
was
you have a question?
Built. So the question is whether there is a designer, because that's the starting point to all the other questions, because God never said that he made humans from chimpanzees or bonobos or anything else. And I think that he's saying that he blatantly did not create humans from something else. He created humans as we are.
Well, you've made your point. Question over here.
My question is in regard to DNA as a complex polymer. My background is in industrial polymers, and despite our best efforts, any of the industrial polymers today begin deteriorating as soon as they're produced. And can you give me an idea as to how DNA could come from those intermediate molecules if they're not stable and they break down within 20, 50 years? Because time's not on our side. It's the other way around.
They are remarkably stable for a biological molecule, but they are replenished by DNA replication over the course of mitosis and meiosis, and they are also repaired continuously. So that the idea of DNA being stable as a polymer is really not a very good analogy, because it's constantly being repaired by a wide variety of mechanisms. It's one of the most energetically complex parts of what our cells do, is to protect our sequences.
But if you assume that, then don't you
assume... I don't assume that. That's been shown.
Okay. If it is shown... Then isn't there a machine there that, in fact, is making repairs and doing
Well, I don't like the phrase machine. There are many proteins and enzymes and RNAzymes that do that.
So how did that come about, that machine or complex unit?
That's the origin of life.
Well, that's probably very, very, very early in living organisms, but there are... simpler systems among prokaryotes, and there are more complex systems in eukaryotes, and we can follow the increase in the complexity of those types of systems as the complexity of the genome increases. So I would say that there's a lot of evidence that things are dynamic in maintaining the patency of our sequence. And I should say, it's not perfect. Otherwise, we wouldn't have variability and we wouldn't have mutations. So they do occur. So it's not a perfect polymer. It's a pretty good one.
Okay.
Question.
Okay, I have a simple question for Dr. Cassone, and the obvious goal of which...
Simple questions are always the most dangerous.
Okay, well, the obvious goal of which is to emphasize the universality of truth and not only the common ground, hopefully, between everyone, but the nobility of its pursuit, and hopefully in the process to dissipate some sense of animosity, which has been admirably minimal here, I think. But the question is, all evidence aside, if presented with the personal decision, if you somehow wielded this power, would you choose, as the ultimate truth, your current viewpoint, or the admittedly more fantastic viewpoint of irreducible complexity and intelligent design?
If I were to choose the last, if I were to get to choose, I must not be able to hear you very well, but if I could go back in time and change my argument, would I change it? Is that the question?
No, like, it's changing the truth, absolutely. Like, disregarding all evidence.
Do I think I've convinced anybody here? Is that what you're saying?
No,
I don't.
No, if you have the choice.
Let's steer clear of worldviews if we can. Can we have a question from this
Well,
guy?
No. I really want to understand the question. Roger, what was it?
You get to choose which world we live in.
Ah.
With irreducible complexity and
intelligent
design,
or
an
Right. Oh, or something that's evolved over seemingly random, crazy changes. Oh, I would pick the evolutionary change any day. It is so cool.
All right.
It's boring to be designed.
Question.
Yes.
This question is for both of you. Scientists normally, of course, prefer experiments to debates. And in fact, many people define a scientific theory as one that can be tested either by experiment or by how reliably it predicts future phenomena. And, of course, to create an experiment to test either of these theories would be ridiculously long, probably wouldn't get congressional funding, and so forth. So the idea of doing an experiment to test either of these theories just isn't going to fly. Therefore, wouldn't it be pretty much, since we can't test the experiment, to test either theory, wouldn't it be pretty much impossible to firmly accept either theory presented tonight without reference to some sort of outside, speculation? As you both seem to have accused each other of doing?
Well, I would maintain that intelligent design doesn't actually serve as a theory because it's not really testable. However, so that's why I split up evolutionary theory into five separate theories, because each of those separable theories are quite testable and have been tested and have never been nullified. So in that context, I think evolutionary theory can be tested and is being tested, and there are many people in this room, not me, that are doing this as we speak. But I should also say, and I'm opening myself up to a design question because it's designed. But there's been some really remarkable computer engineering projects which have simulated evolution in digital theoretical organisms. This is being done at Michigan State primarily by Lentz and Penick and a variety of other people. The program is called Avita, and you can get it on the internet and play with it. It's really quite remarkable. And in that program, which you set up a mutation rate and a selection pressure, under all circumstances, even if you engineer an irreducibly complex sequence, the system evolves and evolves into multiple different types of digital organisms. Now, of course, it's computers. It's a computer universe, and it was initially designed, but it clearly shows that that in a short number of some 150 to 200 generations, you can diversify quite a bit. So both theoretically and in lab bench work, there have been quite a bit of studies testing specific aspects of evolutionary theory.
Can I comment on that question then?
Sure.
Professor Cassone thinks that design can't be tested and irreducible complexity can't be tested, but there are people who disagree with him, like, for example, Russell Doolittle. I hate to keep coming back to this because some people seem to be losing patience, but it's the only experimental result that has been pointed to say that irreducible complexity is incorrect. And if in fact the work had turned out to be as Russell Doolittle had thought it was, then I would have a lot of explaining to do. If you could knock out a couple of components and the system still worked, Russell Doolittle thinks, and I would agree, that my ideas would, you know, be pretty shaky. Maybe, you know, I don't know if they'd be absolutely blown out of the water, but I'd have a tough time explaining them. So I think that irreducible complexity can easily be tested. Intelligent design that says systems can't come about by random mutation and natural selection can easily be blown out of the water by somebody going into his lab, growing some bacteria for a while, and showing that some such system does arise. And that's exactly what Darwinian theory claims can happen. Let me talk about Richard Lenski for a second, who Professor Cassone mentioned. He has started some computer studies with some associates, and it's probably just as well because his experimental studies haven't gone anywhere. For the last decade and a half or so, he has been growing bacteria in his laboratory at Michigan State continuously in an experiment specifically designed to see what evolution can do when run over a long period of time. He's now approaching 40,000 generations of bacteria. And what has he seen? He's seen that there have been a couple of positive mutations where bacteria with those mutations quickly overgrow the other bacteria in the population. It was difficult for him to figure out what those mutations were. He just saw that the bugs overgrew the other ones. But he tracked a couple down. One was that the bugs lost their ability to make the flagellum. Flagellum synthesis takes up a lot of, uses a lot of resources. A bacterium that turns that off has an edge over other bacteria. And that's interesting, but that's not what you'd expect, or that does not tell us where the flagellum came from in the first place. Another positive mutation was the loss of the ability to make ribose. Again, another complex system. He's not quite sure why that helps, but again, it's not a gain of an ability. It's essentially a ship throwing over equipment in order to make itself lighter, to move faster in the water. And again, this is the longest-running experiment specifically designed to test Darwinian theory, and the results are entirely consistent with what I would have predicted going in. It shows absolutely no evidence of the ability of random mutation and natural selection to make a complex system.